Chapter 4. The Indiaman was seen quite early in the morning while Jack was in the pure green sea, with nothing below him for 1,000 fathoms and nothing on either hand but the African shore some hundreds of miles away on the left and the far remoter Americas on the right. He swam and dived, delighting in the coolness and the living run of water along his naked body and through his long, streaming hair. He felt extremely well, aware of his strength and taking joy in it. And for this brief spell while he was not in the ship, he didn't have to think about the innumerable problems to do with her people, her hull, rigging and progress, and the wisest course for her to take, problems that perpetually waited on his mind aboard. He loved the surprise more than any ship he'd known, but even so, half an hour's holiday from her had a certain charm. "Come on," he called to Stephen, standing on the cathead, looking pinched and mean. "The water's like champagne."
"You always say that," muttered Stephen.
"Go on, sir," said Calamy. "It's soon over. You like it once you're in."
Stephen crossed himself, drew a deep breath, grasped his nose with one hand, blocked an ear with the other, closed his eyes and leapt, striking the sea with his buttocks. Because of his curious lack of buoyancy, he remained under the surface for a considerable time. But he came up eventually, and Jack said to him, "Now the Surprise has no one to direct her worldly or her physical or even her spiritual affairs." This was true, for the Surprise's boats were all towing astern so that the heat shouldn't open their seams, and in the last sat Mr. Martin. They were on the edge of the Sargasso Sea, and he'd already taken up a fine collection of weeds, as well as 3 seahorses and 7 species of pelagic crab. "Sail ho!" cried the lookout as the far haze cleared with the rising sun. "On deck there! A sail, 2 points on the starboard bow! 2 sail! 3 sail of ships to gallants up!"
"Stephen," said Jack, "I must go back at once. You can reach the boats, can you not?"
They'd been swimming,
if that was the word for Stephen's laborious jerking progress,
mostly just under the surface, away from the ship. And with their easy motion added to theirs, something in the nature of 25 or even 30 yards now separated the captain from his command, the distance not far from Stephen's limit. "Oh," said he, but a ripple filled his mouth. He coughed, swallowed more, submerged, and began to drown. As usual, Jack dived under him, seized his sparse hair, and drew him up to the surface. And as usual, Stephen folded his hands, closed his eyes, and let himself be towed, floating on his back. Jack abandoned him at Martin's boat, swam fast to the stern ladder, ran straight up the side, and so, pausing only for his shoes, to the masthead. After a moment he called for a glass, and confirmed his first impression that they were homeward-bound Indiamen. Then, hearing the shrill, metallic voice of Mrs. Sergeant James, he called for his breeches to be sent into the main top. On deck he laid a course to intercept them. It would take the Surprise only a trifle out of her way, and hurried below to join the smell of coffee, toast and things frying, bacon among them. Stephen was already there, taking an unfair advantage with the sausages. And as soon as Jack sat down, his other guests appeared, Mowat and the younger Boyle. From time to time, young gentlemen were sent down to report the stranger's appearance and behaviour, and before the feast was over, a disconsolate Calamy came to say that they're only Indiamen, sir, and Captain Pulling said that the nearest was the Lushington. "I'm delighted to hear it," said Jack. "Killick, pray tell my cook to make a special effort today. We shall have 3 company's captains to dinner, and you may rouse out a case of champagne in case we meet early. Sling in 6 in a wet blanket from the cross-jack yard, just under the windward side of the awning." Early they came and late they left, pink and jolly, after a dinner that ended with the Christmas pudding for which Jack's new cook was so justly famous, and measureless wine. A cheerful dinner, since 2 of the captains, Muffet and McQuaid, had been embroiled with a French squadron in the Indian Ocean, together with Jack Aubrey, Pullings and Mowat in this very same ship, and they had a great deal to say, reminding one another just how the wind had veered and how at a given moment Monsieur de Lignois had paid off round and put before it. Cheerful, but as the ships slowly drew apart, Jack paced up and down on his quarter-deck with a grave, considering look on his face. Muffet, an immensely experienced East India sailor, had told him that never in all his time had he known the belt of calms and variable breezes between the southeast and the northeast trades so wide. He and his companions had lost the southeasters in 2 degrees north, and it had taken them more than 500 miles of creeping and towing before they picked up the first true northeaster, and that no more than indifferent strong. The question that he was weighing in his mind was whether, in view of the surprise's mediocre progress, he should now bear away westwards, abandoning the Cape Verde Islands and their water, and relying upon the torrential rain that so often fell in storms between 9 and 3 degrees north of the line. The water collected in sails and awnings had a villainous taste of hemp and tar, and at first it was scarcely drinkable. But the saving of several days might prove to be of the first importance, since it was by no means sure that the Norfolk would have had the same paltry breezes. Yet it was by no means sure that the surprise would be rained on either. The rainstorms in that belt, though sometimes almost unbelievably heavy, were limited in size. Before now he'd passed through the variables without once being wetted, though he'd seen black masses of cloud on either horizon, or little isolated storms here and there in 3 or 4 places at once, with miles of clear water in between. And the fate of the waterless ship in the calms was horrible to contemplate. On the other hand, the atmosphere of that region, though hellfire hot, was always intensely humid. You didn't feel very thirsty, and much more fresh water was used for steeping the salt meat than for drinking. His mind so ran on these things that when he and Stephen were playing that night, his fingers, which should have been providing a mild deedly-deedly-deedly background to the cello's long statement in a slow, and perhaps rather dull, movement they both knew perfectly well, wandered off at a point of easy transition to another slow movement by the same composer, and were only pulled up by a shocking discord and by Stephen's indignant cries. Where did Jack think he was going to? What would he be at? "I beg your pardon 1,000 times, Sir Jack. I'm in the D minor piece. I've been gathering moss. But I've just made up my mind. Forgive me a moment." He went on deck, altered the dear ship's course to southwest by south, and coming back, he said with a contented look, "There. We may die of thirst in the next few weeks if it don't rain, but at least we shan't miss the Norfolk. I mean," he added, clapping his hand to the wood of his chair, "we're somewhat less likely to miss her now. Yet, on the other hand, I'm afraid you'll have to tell poor Mr. Martin that he'll not see the Cape Verdes after all. The poor soul will be sadly disappointed. He knows far more about beetles than I do. And it appears that the Cape Verdes rejoice in a wonderful variety of tetramere, forbidding though they may appear to a shallow, superficial mind. I shall break it to him gently, but will I tell you something, Jack? Our hearts are not in the music tonight. I know mine is not, and I believe I shall take a turn in the air and then go to bed. You're not offended by my moss, Stephen, are you?" asked Jack. "Never in life, soul," said Stephen. "I was uneasy in my mind before ever we sat down. And for once music has not answered." It was quite true. That afternoon Stephen had gone through the papers that had accumulated in his cabin, throwing most away and reducing the others to some kind of order, and among those he discarded was the most recent of a series of letters from a well-wisher, who regularly sent to let him know that his wife was unfaithful to him. Usually these letters only aroused a mild wonder in him, a mild desire to know who it was who took so much trouble. But now, partly because of a dream and partly because he knew that appearances were against him, that he certainly appeared to have been traipsing about with Laura Fielding, it reinforced an anxiety that had been with him ever since the mail first reached the Surprise in Gibraltar. Although by most standards their marriage would hardly have been called successful, he was very deeply attached to her, and the thought of her being angry with him, together with the frustration of being unable to communicate with her, overcame both the usual steadiness of his mind and his persuasion that the letter carried by Ray would convince her of his unaltered regard, in spite of the fact that his explanation of Mrs. Fielding's presence was necessarily incomplete, and in some respects quite false. For now, in his present low state, it was borne in upon him that falsity sometimes had the same penetrating quality as truth. Both were perceived intuitively, and Diana was intuition's favourite child. He paused in the waist of the ship, with the strong breeze eddying about him, before he groped his way up the ladder to the quarter-deck. The night was as black as a night could be. Warm, velvet black, with no stars at all. He could detect the ship's motion by her urgent heave and thrust, and living vibration of the wood under his hand and the creak of the blocks, cordage and canvas overhead. But never a sail nor a rope could he see, nor even the steps in front of his nose as he crept up. He might have been entirely deprived of the sense of sight, and it was only when he brought his nose above the break of the quarter-deck that his eyes returned to him, with the glow of the quartermaster at the conn, a grey-haired man named Richardson, and of Walsh, the much younger timoneer. Quite close at hand he made out the hint of a darker form looming this side of the mainmast, and to this form he said, "Good night, now, Mr. Honey. Would the chaplain be aboard at all?" "It's me, sir," said Mowat, chuckling. "I swapped with Honey." "Yes, Mr. Martin's still up. He's in the launch, towing astern. And I doubt he comes in till sunrise, it being so uncommon dark and awkward. You could just make him out if you look over the side." Stephen looked. There was not much phosphorescence on the sea, although it was so warm, but there was enough for the troubled wake to show as it swirled about the towing boats, and in the farthest he could just distinguish the rise and fall of Martin's little net. "Perhaps you'd like to join him?" suggested Mowat. "I'll give you a hand over the taffrail, if you choose."
"I do not choose,"
said Stephen, contemplating the length of faintly luminous water and the increasing perturbation of the train of boats. Barge, gig, jolly boat, and both the cutters, all quite far apart, that would have to be traversed before the launch was reached.
"Bad news will always keep. But listen, James Mowat, are they not tossing about in a very dreadful manner? Is there not some danger of their being drawn below the surface, engulfed in the middle stream of the wake, and of Mr. Martin's being lost?"
"Oh, dear me, no, sir," said Mowat, "no danger at all. And was it to come on to blow, to really, as one might say, blow, why, I should back a topsail, hail him alongside, and so pass him a line. Ain't it agreeable to be moving at last? This is the first time we've done better than 5 knots since we laid the rock. The barkey began to speak at the beginning of the watch, and now she must be throwing a fine bow wave, if only we could see it. She plies her course yet, nor her winged speed the falcon could for pace exceed."
"Are those your lines, Mr. Mowat?"
"No, no, alas, they're Homer's. Lord, what a fellow he was. Ever since I began reading in him, I've quite lost any notion of writing myself, he being such a..."
Mowat's voice trailed away in admiration, and Stephen said, "I had no idea you were a Grecian."
"No more I am, sir," replied Mowat. "I read him in a translation, a book a young lady gave me for a keepsake in Gibraltar by a cove named Chapman, a very splendid cove. I began because I esteemed the giver and because I hoped to be able to knock poor Rowan on the head with some pretty good images and rhymes when he rejoined. But I went on because I couldn't stop. Do you know him?"
"Not I," said Stephen, "though I did look into Mr. Pope's version once, and Madame Dacier's.
I hope your Mr. Chapman is better. Oh, it's magnificent. A great booming sometimes, like a heavy sea, the Iliad being in 14ers. And I'm sure it's very like the Greek. I must show it to you. But then I dare say you've read him in the original. They had no choice. When I was a boy, it was Homer and Virgil entirely, and many a stripe and many a tear between. But I came to love him for all that, and I quite agree with you. He's the very prince of poets. The Odyssey's a fine tale, sure, though I never could cordially like Ulysses. He lied excessively, it seems to me. And if a man lies beyond a certain point, a sad falseness enters into him, and he's no longer amiable. Stephen spoke with some feeling. His work in Intelligence had called for a great deal of duplicity, perhaps too much. No longer amiable. And I shouldn't quarrel with those who say that Homer had no great hand in the poem, but the Iliad, oh, God love his soul, never was such a book as the Iliad. Moet cried that the doctor was in the right of it and began to recite a particularly valued piece, soon losing himself, however. But Stephen scarcely heard. His mind glowed with recollection, and he exclaimed, "And the truly heroic scale that makes us all look so mean and pallid, and the infinite art from the beginning to the noble end, with Achilles and Priam talking quietly together in the night, both doomed and both known to be doomed. The noble end and its full close. For I don't count the funeral rites as anything but a necessary form, almost an appendix. The book is full of death, but, oh, so living." Four bells interrupted them. And clear round the ship came the cry of the lookouts and the sentinels. "Lifebuoy, all's well. Starboard gangway, all's well. Starboard bow, all's well," followed by all the rest. The carpenter's mate, bringing a lantern with him, reported 11 inches in the well, half an hour's pumping at dawn, and the midshipman of the watch, having fussed some little time with the lantern and the sandglass, said, "7 knots, 1 fathom, sir, if you please." Merritt wrote this on the logboard. The lantern vanished down a hatchway. The darkness returned, even thicker than before. And Stephen said, "There was a foolish man of Lampsacus, Metrodorus by name, that explained away the gods and the heroes as personifications of this and that, of fire and water, the sky and the sun, and so on. Agamemnon was the upper air, as I recall. And then there were a great many busy fellows who found out hidden meanings in Homer by the score. And some would have it that the Odyssey in particular was an enormous, great, bloated metaphor, the way the writer of it would have seen a superior acrostic monger. But as far as I know, not one of the inky boobies ever saw what is as clear as the sun at midday. That as well as being the great epic of the world, the Iliad is a continued outcry against adultery. Hundreds, nay, thousands of heroical young men killed. Troy town in blood and flames. Andromache's child dashed from the battlements and she led away to carry water for Greek women. The great city razed and depopulated, all from mere adultery. And she didn't even like the worthless fellow at the end. James Mowat, there is nothing to be said for adultery." "No, sir," said Mowat, smiling in the darkness. Partly from recollections of his own, and partly, like everybody else aboard, all the old surprises, that's to say, he was as certain of Dr. Maturin's criminal conversation with Mrs. Fielding as if he'd seen them kiss and clip in naked bed. "No, sir, nothing at all. And I have sometimes thought of giving him a hint, but these things are too delicate, and I doubt it would answer." "Yes, Boyle, what is it?" "Who is this him?" said Maturin to himself. "I beg your pardon, sir," said Boyle, "but I believe there's a hail from the launch." "Then lay aft and see what's afoot. Take my speaking trumpet and sing out loud and clear." Boyle sang out loud and clear, and coming back he said, As far as I could make out, sir, the chaplain wishes to know whether we apprehend any worsening of the tempest. It's what we've been praying for this last age, after all, said Mowat. But perhaps we'd better bring the launch under the counter. He may be a little uneasy in his mind. Jump down and help him up the stern ladder. There'll be plenty of light from the cabin.
How very kind of you, said Martin, sitting on the capstan to recover his breath after his climb. The boat was plunging up and down in the most alarming fashion, and I could make no observations at all this last half hour.
What were you observing, sir?
Luminous organisms, mostly minute pelagic crustaceans, copepods. But I need calmer water for it, the good calm water we've had almost all the way. How I pray it may grow quiet again before we leave the Sargasso quite behind.
I don't know about the Sargasso, said Mowat, but I think you may be pretty sure of calm weather before we cross the line.
And indeed long, long before they crossed the line, the trade wind died in the frigate's wake and left her with her towering canvas limp. All the noble expanse she'd spread to catch the lightest airs, hanging there discouraged, and the ship rolling horribly on the great smooth swell.
So these are the doldrums,
said Martin, coming on deck in his best coat, the coat worn for invitations to the cabin, and looking about the hot, lowering sky and the glassy sea with great satisfaction.
I've always wanted to see them, yet even so I believe I shall take off my coat until dinner time.
It will make no odds,
said Stephen, whose spirit of contradiction was more lively than usual because of a sleepless night, much of it filled with longing for his private vice, the alcoholic tincture of laudanum, a form of liquid opium that had consoled him in anxiety, unhappiness, privation, pain and insomnia for many a year, but which he'd given up, except medicinally, on his marriage with Diana.
Your coat protects you from the radiant heat of the sun, and the mechanism of your body maintains it at a constant temperature. As you know, the Arab of the desert goes covered from head to foot. The apparent relief is a mere illusion of vulgar error. Martin was not a man to be overborne, however. He took off his coat, folded it carefully on the hammock cloth, and said, "The vulgar error is wonderfully refreshing, nevertheless."
"And as for the doldrums," Stephen went on, "I believe you may perhaps misuse the term. As I understand it, in nautical language, the doldrums are a condition, a state, not a region. They are analogous to tantrums. A child, and, God help us, a grown man, alas, can be in the tantrums anywhere at all. Similarly, a ship may be in the doldrums, wherever she is long becalmed. I may be mistaken, but Captain Aubrey will certainly know."
Captain Aubrey knew. But since they were his guests, he contrived to agree with both, though inclining somewhat in the chaplain's favour. He conceived that, from seaman's slang or cant, doldrums was become a general word by land, used in Mr. Martin's sense of what used to be called the variables. He had a great esteem for Mr. Martin. He valued him. But he didn't invite him as often as he felt he should. And now, by way of making amends, he not only filled his glass very often and helped him to the best cuts of the leg of mutton, but also strained the truth in his direction. The fact of the matter was that he felt a constraint in Martin's presence. He'd known few parsons, and his respect for the cloth made him feel that a grave face and a sober discourse, preferably on topics of a moral nature, were called for in their presence. And although he didn't much delight in bawdy, indeed never talked it except in bawdy company, where the reverse would have seemed offensively pious, the compulsory decorum weighed upon him. Then again, although Mr. Martin loved music, he was an indifferent performer, and after one or two sadly discordant evenings full of apology, he hadn't been asked to play in the cabin again. Jack was, therefore, more than usually attentive to his guest, not only congratulating him quite sincerely upon his sermon that morning, not only feeding and whining him to a pitch that few men could have withstood in a temperature of 104 with a humidity of 85, but telling him in some detail of the sail that was to be put over the side that afternoon for the hands to swim in. Those hands, that was to say, who couldn't take to the sea itself for fear of drowning. This led on to observations about seamen's, particularly fishermen's, reluctance to be taught to swim. And at the far end of the table, Pullings, who, as a captain by courtesy, was allowed to pipe up of his own accord, said, "It's a great while since you've saved anyone, sir." "I suppose it is," said Jack. "Does the captain often save people?" asked Martin. "Oh, dear me, yes, one or two every commission, or more. I dare say you could man the barge with the hands you've saved, couldn't you, sir?" "Perhaps I could," said Jack absently. And then, feeling that he wasn't doing his duty by his other guest, he said, "I hope we shall see you over the side this afternoon, Mr. Hollam. Do you swim?"
"Not a stroke, sir," said Hollam, speaking for the first time.
And he added, after a slight pause, "But I shall join the others in splashing about in the sail. It would be a rare treat to feel cool." A rare treat indeed. Even at night, heat seemed to emanate from the bloody moon. And during the oppressive, stifling days, the sun, even from behind its frequent low cloud, made the pitch bubble in the seams of the deck, and the tar melt so that it dripped from the upper rigging, while resin oozed from under the paint and drooled down the sides as the ship towed slowly south and west, all boats out ahead, and the pullers relieved each glass. Sometimes a hot, capricious breeze would ruffle the oily sea, and all hands would dart to brace the yards to take advantage of it. But rarely did the surprise travel more than a mile or so before the breeze came foul or died away altogether, leaving her lifeless on the swell, rolling to such a degree that in spite of their strengthened and new-swifted shrouds and doubled backstays, her masts were in danger of going by the board, even with the topgallants struck down on deck. And not only Mrs. Lamb, but also some of the defenders' landsmen took to their beds again with utterly prostrating sickness. It was a wearisome time, and it seemed to last for ever. One day's noon observation could be distinguished from the last only by the finest instruments used with the greatest skill. The heat worked right down into the lowest depths of the ship, making the bilge water stink most vilely, so that those whose cabins lay far below, Stephen and the chaplain among them, had but little sleep. And when they came on deck in the night watches, carrying rolls of sailcloth against the soft pitch of the seams, they were cruelly chivied from place to place as the hands, usually under their captain's immediate command, raced to catch the last waft of air. It was a time when theories crumbled. Although he was as impervious to heat as a salamander, revelled in it indeed, Stephen shed his stuff coat, his cloth breeches, his good wool stockings, and appeared in a white banyan jacket, usually open on his meagre chest, airy nankeen pantaloons, and a broad-brimmed sennit hat plaited for him by Bomden, whom he'd taught to read many years before in these same waters. Far, far kinder waters then, and a very much quicker passage, incalculably cheaper as far as expensive spirit was concerned. In the same way, Jack's views on humidity didn't prevent him from drinking up his whole private supply of East India pale ale, nor from going over their supplies of water with the master again and again, adding up what was left in the 159-gallon leaguers of the ground tier, the 108-gallon butts, the hogsheads and half-hogsheads laid bung up and bilge-free in the wings, and coming to a most discouraging sum total. Even at no more than a purser's quarter head, a far cry from the gallon of beer of home waters, the store diminished by nearly half a ton each day, and that took no account of the great quantity absolutely required for making the salt meat edible. They did come in for the skirt of a rainstorm in 6 degrees 25 minutes north, but it did little more than prepare their spread-out awnings and sails, cleaning them for the next hypothetical downpour. The few butts of water they collected were so brackish and tarry and full of makers' dressing from the new sailcloth that it couldn't be drunk in their present moderate state of need. Jack had it barreled, however. If this went on, they'd give 10 years' pay for a cup of a far worse brew. He was worried. First by the lack of water, of course, but also by his lack of progress. He knew the Norfolk, and he knew that if she was commanded by any of the American officers he'd met about the Constitution, or as a prisoner of war in Boston, she'd be running south as fast as ever she could go with due regard to her masts and rigging. She might even make up a month's delay and pass Cape Saint Roch before him. The ship's people worried him too. The Surprises had accepted and absorbed the Gibraltar lunatics, treating them kindly, cutting up their meat for them and bawling into their ears when they couldn't quite understand. But in spite of the heavy shared labour of towing ship and of the changes he'd introduced into the watch bill, most of the defenders they couldn't bear. Almost all the punishment inflicted was brought about by fighting between the two sides, and Jack looked forward to the eventual crossing of the line with real anxiety. In the traditional rough fun, ill will could take an ugly shape. He'd known unpopular men maimed before this, and one actually drowned during the horseplay. That was when Jack was a master's mate in the Formidable. And his anxiety was increased by the fact that tempers were wearing precious thin with continual toil and the great oppressive heat and the short commons. Of course, being sole master after God, he could forbid the ceremony, but he'd be ashamed to command a ship ruled in such a manner. Then again, there was something in the air, something he couldn't yet define. Jack had been lucky in the matter of employment, spending most of his life afloat, and this had given him more experience of ship's companies than most officers of his seniority, and his experience had also been more extensive, since an irascible captain had disrated Mr. Midshipman Aubrey at the Cape, turning him before the mast as a common hand, there to live, eat, sleep and work with the rest of the men. This had brought him intimately acquainted with seamen's ways and moods, the significance of their looks, gestures and silences. And now he was certain that something was afoot, something concealed but generally understood. It was quite certainly not a hatching mutiny, and it was certainly not the heavy gambling he'd known in a few ships rich in prize money, since the Surprises now had barely a groat between them. But there was a certain excitement, and there was a certain secrecy that might have belonged to either. He was quite right. And this something was understood throughout the ship by everybody except her captain, her chaplain, and, of course, her gunner. In a crowded man-of-war, it was very difficult to carry out anything privately, and all hands knew that Mr. Hollam was having to do with Mrs. Horner. He was ideally placed for such an enterprise, since he slung his hammock in the midshipman's berth, and the gunner's realm, where Mrs. Horner looked after the youngsters, was just at hand. Very few other men in the ship could be in those parts without exciting comment, and now that he was reasonably well fed, Hollam made full use of his opportunities. It was generally thought that he made too full use of them, that after a discreet beginning he'd grown overconfident, and that presently he'd cop it something cruel. Hollam was not a man to bully the hands or bring them up for punishment, so he was not at all actively disliked. But since he wasn't much of a seaman, he wasn't respected either. And then, in spite of his good luck for the moment, his much envied good luck, there was always the possibility of his being a Jonah. He remained a stranger to the ship. Much the same applied to Horner, whose sullen temper and underlying ferocity made him no friends aboard, though for his part he was respected as an efficient gunner and feared as a right awkward bastard if crossed. So there were these two strangers to be watched with the liveliest interest in the intervals of trying to draw the ship out of the variables. And as the couple's caution grew less, So it seemed to the fascinated spectator that the explosion must be coming near. But these conjectures, though freely exchanged, never reached the cabin. And in the gunroom they were repressed when the chaplain was present. Jack, therefore, remained ignorant of the specific reason for the knowing looks that he observed from his usual post by the Windward Hanses. But even if he had known, he would still have ordered the boats away when the Bonitos appeared. At dawn, flying fish had been found on deck by the score, and as the sun rose, their persecutors could be seen skimming about in schools just under the surface. The boats, plying net and line with prodigious zeal, brought in several loads of fish, fish that didn't have to be steeped in precious fresh water. And as Stephen remarked to Martin, the Bonito, like his cousin the great Tunny, was not only a warm-blooded fish, but also a great promoter of Venus. All hands, except Mrs. Lamb, ate as much Bonito as they could hold. And after the feast, Holland's lovely Rose in June could be heard coming from below, he now being off duty. The gunner came on deck to attend to one of the forecastle carronades. The song stopped abruptly. On the forecastle, the gunner clapped his hand to his pocket, missed his handkerchief, and began walking back to his cabin. The couple were saved only by the pipe of all hands, as Jack decided that the patch of dark purple cloud with lightning flickering beneath it on the far northeast might possibly bring the edge of a turning squall down to them, and that it would be as well to strike the topgallant masts, although they'd been swayed up only a few hours before, to catch the last gasp of the flying fish breeze. It was as well that he did so, for the squall turned more sharply than he or Pullings or the master had expected. After various evolutions, it came hissing across the calm sea on the larboard quarter, a line of white advancing at 35 miles an hour, backed by impenetrable darkness and preceded by three small pale birds racing across its front. It struck the ship with a mounting howl, laying her right over and shooting Stephen and Martin, who had incautiously let go their hold in an attempt at identifying the pale birds with their spyglasses, into the lee scuppers. Even before kindly hands had plucked them out, the whole air was one roaring mass of rain, warm and so thick with great drops and with finely divided water dust that they could scarcely breathe as they crept up the sloping deck, and the scuppers were already spouting wide. "I beg your pardon?" shouted Martin through the almighty omnipresent din. "I was only calling out butcher to the doctor," roared Jack into his ear. "That's what we say at sea when somebody falls down. Here, clap onto the fife rail." For 10 minutes the Surprise raced along under a close reef foretopsail, and as soon as the wind had moderated a little, they began to spread various cloths for the rain and to rouse out barrels. But unhappily the downpour had almost spent itself in the useless flooding of the deck, and part of what was collected in the main royal, stretched between the stanchions of the forecastle and weighted with round shot, was lost when Mr. Hollam cast off the wrong hitch, being somewhat bemused in his intellect. Still, in the short time it lasted, they gathered water for 8 days, very pure water, and the women aboard, even the almost paralytic Mrs. Lamb, had filled all possible tubs and buckets. Their smalls were already put to soak. And what was even better, the squall was followed by a steady breeze, perhaps the first breath of the southeast trades. Yet these things had to be paid for, of course. The sun-baked decks leaked abominably, and the Surprise, though bowling along so cheerfully, echoed with the sound of drips right down to the orlop and the hold itself, wetting all the storerooms except the tin-lined breadroom, all the cabins, and all the hanging beds within these cabins. And even before the evening sun went down in its abrupt tropical fashion, the hot, imprisoned air was filled with the smell of mould, mould, blue or green, or sometimes a mottled grey, growing on books, clothes, shoes, marine specimens, portable soup, and, of course, the great beams under which everybody slept and against which everybody except the captain banged his head from time to time. This was not because Jack Aubrey was more dwarfish than the rest. Indeed, he stood rather more than 6 feet tall, but because his cabin had more clearance. Or rather, his cabins, since he had three. The coach to larboard, which included the lower part of the mizzenmast and a 32-pounder carronade, and in which he had his meals unless there were more than 4 or 5 guests. His sleeping place to starboard. And then right aft, the noble great cabin, stretching clean across the ship and lit by the splendid, curved, inward-sloping, 7-light stern window. The airiest, lightest, most desirable place in the ship. Killick's kingdom, perpetually scoured, swabbed, scraped and polished, smelling of beeswax, fresh seawater and clean paint. "Perhaps we might have some music tonight," suggested Stephen, coming up from his fetid dog-hole. "Oh, Lord, no," cried Jack at once. "So long as this charming zephyr lasts, I must sail the ship. I must stay on deck." "Shouldn't sail whether you're on deck or not. You've capable officers, for all love. And they must sit up in any case. Their watch is coming in due succession." "That's eminently true," said Jack. "But in a near-run thing, it's a captain's duty to be on deck, urging his ship through the water by the combined effort of his will and his belly muscles. You may say it's buying a dog and barking at the stable door yourself. The stable door after it is locked," said Stephen, holding up his hand. "Just so. The stable door after it's locked. Yourself. But there are more things in heaven and earth, you know. Stephen, will you not sit in the cabin and play by yourself, or invite Martin, or transcribe the Scarlatti for fiddle and cello?"
"I will not,"
said Stephen, who hated any appearance of favouritism. And he vanished into the smelly gun-room, there to play halfpenny whist with Martin, Mr. Adams and the master, a game in which concentration was rather harder than usual, since Howard the Marine was learning to play the German flute according to a method which, though said to be adapted to the meanest understanding, puzzled him extremely, while Mowat was reading pieces of the Iliad to Honey in a low voice but with immense relish, so that Dr. Maturin was not altogether sorry when the loblolly boy called him away to make his evening rounds with Mr. Higgins. On deck, Captain Aubrey, eating a piece of cold, or at least lukewarm, peas pudding with one hand, and holding on to the aftermost main-to-gallant standing backstay with the other, did indeed urge his ship on with contractions of his belly muscles and a continuous effort of his will. But he also did a great deal more than that. It was quite true that he had competent officers, and Pullings and Mowat in particular knew the dear frigate very well. Yet he had known her longer by far. His initials on her foretopmast cap had been carved there when he was an unruly, mast-headed boy. And not to put too fine a point on it, he sailed her better. He might almost have been riding a high-mettled horse, whose moods and paces were as familiar to him as his own. For although he never hauled on a rope, nor laid a hand on the wheel, except now and then to feel the vibration of a rudder and the precise degree of its bite, he had a highly responsive crew, men with whom he'd sailed the ship in pursuit of splendid prizes or in flight from hopelessly superior force, and through them he was in the closest touch with her. He'd long since abandoned the cautious show of canvas, the snugging down with reef topsails of the early days of the voyage, and now the surprise ran through the night with stunsails aloft and alow as long as they would stand. As for the hands, most of them were perfectly aware that this was another occasion on which the ship was flying from a hopelessly superior force. They'd observed the captain's retention of the first barrels of noisome rainwater. Through the ever-present servants, they'd heard all the conversations in the cabin and the gun-room on the subject, and by plain eavesdropping all those on the quarter-deck. And those few contrary-minded or heavy-arsed dullards who weren't convinced by their shipmates' rhetoric were wholly persuaded by the succession of prime helmsmen being called to the wheel out of their turn, by the continuous presence of the skipper watch after watch, and by his insistence that they should flash out jibs and staysails with supernatural speed. He was still there at dawn, taking advantage of every heave of the ocean or thrust of the wind to drive the ship a little farther, a little faster. The breeze had veered southerly, and at this point the Surprise was as close-hauled as she could be, her weather-leeches shaking. It grew much stronger with the rising sun, and now she really showed what she could do on a bowline. Her lee forechains under the splendid foam of her bow wave, a white line racing down her side in a curve so deep that her copper showed amidships, and a broad wake that fled out straight behind her, a sea mile every 5 minutes. With the idlers called and both watches on deck, he packed them along the weather rail to make her stiffer still, set his main royal and stood there, braced against the slope of the deck, soaked with flying spray, his face drawn and covered with the bright yellow bristles of unshaven beard, looking perfectly delighted. He was still there at noon, when the breeze, somewhat more moderate but now blowing with beautiful steadiness from the east-southeast, had declared itself to be the true trade wind. And with infinite satisfaction he, the master, and all the other officers found, when the sun crossed the meridian, that between this observation and the last, the Surprise had covered 192 miles, running clean out of the zone of calms and variables. After an early dinner, he spent the afternoon in his cot, lying on his back and snoring, with such a volume and persistence that men as far forward as the belfry winked at one another, grinning. And Mrs. Lamb, speaking in a low voice and shaking her head, told the wife of the Sergeant of Marines that she pitied poor Mrs. Aubrey from the bottom of her heart. But he was up and about for quarters, and since both watches had been called in the night, he'd let the evening go with no more than the very popular and unlaborious form of small-arms exercise, in which all hands, including the Marines, fired at a bottle hanging from the fore-yard arm. And when at last the drum beat the retreat, he astonished Pullings and Mowat by observing that perhaps tomorrow they might start painting the ship. There wasn't much point in scraping the decks yet, the pitch being so soft, but they'd be very sorry to have any merchantman or Portuguese man-of-war see the Surprise in her present state of abysmal squalor. What he said was perfectly true. Although a boat had pulled round her every morning when it was practicable, with the captain of the head and his mates swabbing all that could be swabbed, resin, tar, pitch, and oily seaborne filth had dimmed the frigate's brilliant Nelson checker, and her gingerbread work was not at all what a loving first lieutenant's eye could have wished. But these things were generally attended to late in a voyage, when there was some likelihood that the freshness of the effect would strike all beholders dumb with admiration. And at present, the Surprise was well over 500 miles from the nearest point of Brazil. Furthermore, painting ship almost always meant slower progress. And although, of course, it would have to be done before they reached soundings, Pullings would have expected Jack not to delay this side of the line for anything but a rainstorm to fill their rows and rows of empty barrels. Yet both he and Mowat had been brought up from boyhood in a service that didn't encourage the questioning of orders, and their "yes, sir" came with no more than a barely measurable hesitation. Dr. Maturin had no such inhibitions. When he came into the cabin that evening, he waited until Jack had finished a charming little rondo, and then said, "And are we not to make haste and cut the line tomorrow, so?" "No," said Jack, smiling at him. "If this wind holds, and it's almost certain to mind its duty as a true trade wind,
I hope to cross in a little more than 29 degrees of west latitude on Sunday. So tomorrow you should be quite near your old friends, the St. Paul's Rocks.
Is that right? What joy! I must tell poor Martin. Tell me, what was the rondo you were playing?
Malta.
Malta? Yes, you know.
Malta Vivace. You must have heard of Malta Vivace.
When at last he'd had his laugh out, he wiped his eyes and wheezed. It came to me in a flash. A brilliant illumination, like when you fire off blue lights. Lord, ain't I a rattle? I shall set up for a wit yet and make my fortune. Malta Vivace. I must tell Sophie. I'm writing her a letter to be put aboard some homeward-bound merchantman if we meet one off Brazil next week, which is probable. Malta Vivace. Ah, dear me.
He that would make a pun would pick a pocket, said Stephen. And that miserable quibble isn't even a pun, but a vile clench. Who is this Malta? He asked, picking up the neatly written score.
You had milk in Malta, a German of the last age, said Jack.
Our parson at home thinks the world of him. I copied this piece, mislaid it, and found it 10 minutes ago tucked behind our Corelli in C major. Shall we attempt the Corelli now, it being such a triumphal day?
Nobody could have called the next day triumphal. The Surprise had stages rigged out over her sides, and all hands turned to scraping her wood and hammering the rust off her ironwork, and then laying on paint and various kinds of blacking.
Early in the morning, Stephen had told Martin of their approach to St. Paul's Rocks, which, in the right season of the year, harboured not only a large variety of terns, but also two steganopodes, the brown and far more rarely the blue-faced booby. This was not the right season, but there was some hope of stragglers, and as soon as their duties permitted, they took chairs to various vantage points from which they might lean their telescopes to look for boobies, and even perhaps to view the rocks themselves rearing lonely from the ocean. But rarely had they settled for 10 minutes before they were desired to move, to mind the paintwork, sir, for God's sake, to mind the paintwork. And when they hovered near the taffrail and the elegant gilded carving, they were told that they might stay a little while, so long as they touched nothing, but they were not on any account to breathe on the gold leaf until the egg white had dried, and they must certainly not lean their glasses on the rail at any time. Even the boats were better than this. Although at sea level the horizon was brought in to a mere 3 miles. Yet presently the boats too were hauled in for scraping and painting, and when they showed a certain restiveness they were told that they wouldn't like to have the barkey mistaken for a Newcastle collier by a parcel of Portuguese, nor boats for mudscows. It was Calamy who suggested that they should go into the foretop, from which, the foretops will be clued up, they could see almost the whole ring of the world, and that for an immense distance too. He helped them to climb up, settling them comfortably on the stunsails that were kept there, and brought them their telescopes, a broad-brimmed straw hat apiece to preserve their brains from the now almost vertical furnace of the enormous sun, and a pocket full of those broken ends of biscuit known as midshipmen's nuts against hunger, since dinner was likely to be late. And it was from this lofty platform that they first saw an undoubted frigate petrel, and then, following the cry of the lookout on the main-to-gallant yard, the white nick on the horizon as St. Paul's Rocks heaved up in the southwest.
Oh! Oh!
Said Martin, putting his glass to his single eye and focusing carefully.
Can it be?
A line of heavy, purposeful birds came flying towards the ship, quite fast, not very high. 100 yards out
on the starboard beam, they checked their run, poised, and plunged one after another like gannets. A headlong dive that sent water jetting up. They rose, circled, dived for some few minutes more, and then flew off with equal purpose to the northeast. Martin relaxed, lowered his glass, and turned a radiant face to Stephen. I have beheld the blue-faced booby, he said, shaking him by the hand. Long before this, the seven bellmen had gone to their turpentine-tasting dinner, followed one glass later by the rest of the hands with their customary bellowing. Now Heart of Oak was beating for the gunroom feast, and presently a messenger came up to tell them that the gentlemen were waiting. My best compliments to Captain Pullings, said Stephen, and beg to be excused. Martin said much of the same, and they returned to their contemplation of these barren islands now quite near. Never a herb, never a blade of grass, observed Stephen, nor yet a drop of water would but fall from the sky. The birds to the left are only noddies, I'm afraid, but then on the topmost round there is a booby, my dear sir, a brown booby. He's in a sad state of molt, poor fellow, but he's still a true brown booby. All that white is the droppings of the birds, of course, many feet thick in places, and it has so strong an ammoniac reek that it catches you by the throat. I was ashore there once when the birds were breeding, barely a foot of ground without an egg, and the fowls so tame you could pick them up. Do you think the captain would stop for just half an hour? Asked Martin. Think what beetles might be there. Couldn't it be represented to him? My poor friend, said Stephen. If anything would exceed the sea officer's brutish indifference to birds, it would be his brutish indifference to beetles. And do but look at the boats in their new wet paint. I was able to go only because we were becalmed, whereas now we're running at 5 knots. And because it was a Sunday, and because an officer very kindly rowed me over in a boat. James Nichols was his name. His mind went back to that deeply unhappy man who had almost certainly let himself be drowned off this very rock, but was now going gently astern a short mile away. He'd disagreed with his wife, had tried to make peace, and no peace came. Stephen's thoughts moved on from James Nichols to marriage in general, that difficult state. He'd heard of a race of lizards in the Caucasus that reproduced themselves parthenogenetically, with no sexual congress of any kind, no sexual complications. Lacerta saxicola was their name. Marriage, its sorrow and woe, its fragile joys, filled his mind. And he was not altogether surprised when Martin, speaking in a low, confidential tone, told him that he had long been attached to the daughter of a parson, a young lady whose brother he used to botanise with when they were at the university together. She was considerably above him in the worldly consequence, and her friends looked upon him with disapproval. Nevertheless, in view of his now very much greater affluence, his income of £211.8 a year, he thought of asking her to be his wife. Yet there were many things that troubled him. One was that her friends might not regard even £211.8 as wealth. Another was his appearance. Maturin had no doubt noticed that he had only one eye, which must necessarily tell against him. And still another was the difficulty of setting out his mind in a letter,
Martin wasn't unaccustomed to composition, but he'd been able to do no better than this. He hoped Maturin would be so good as to glance over it and give him his candid opinion. The sun beat down upon the foretop. The paper curled in Stephen's hand. His heart sank steadily. Martin was a thoroughly amiable man, the man of wide reading. But when he came to write, he mounted upon a pair of stilts, unusually lofty stilts, and staggered along at a most ungracious pace with an occasional awkward lurch into colloquialism, giving a strikingly false impression of himself. Stephen handed the letter back and said, "It's very elegantly put indeed, with some uncommon pretty figures, and I'm sure it would touch any lady's heart. But, my dear Martin, you must allow me to say that I believe your whole approach to be mistaken. You apologise from beginning to end. From start to finish, you're exceedingly humble. There is a quotation that hovers just beyond the reach of my recollection, together with the name of its author, to the effect that even the most virtuous woman despises an impotent man. And surely all self-depreciation runs along the same unhappy road. I'm convinced that the best way of making an offer of marriage is the shortest. A plain, perfectly legible letter reading, 'My dear madam, I beg you will do me the honour of marrying me. I remain, dear madam, with the utmost respect, your humble obedient servant.' That goes straight to the heart of the matter. On a separate half-sheet, one could perhaps add a statement of one's income for the consideration of the lady's friends, together with an expression of willingness to make any settlements they may think fit." "Perhaps so," said Martin, folding his paper away. "Perhaps so. I'm very much obliged to you for the suggestion." But it required no very great penetration to see that he was not convinced, that he still clung to his carefully balanced periods, his similes, his metaphors, and his peroration. He'd shown his letter to Maturin partly as a mark of confidence and esteem, being sincerely attached to him, and partly so that Maturin might praise it, possibly adding a few well-turned phrases. For like most normally constituted writers, Martin had no use for any candid opinion that wasn't wholly favourable. "What a wonderfully true voice Mr. Hollam does possess, to be sure," he said, cocking his ear towards the deck after a silent pause. "A great blessing to any choir." From this they went on to speak of the life of chaplains afloat, of naval surgeons, and of the surprise. "Martin, she's quite unlike any of the ships I've been in. There's none of that running at the men with canes and knotted ropes, no kicking, few really harsh words. And if it weren't for these unfortunate defenders and their fighting with the surprises, there'd be almost no punishment days. Or at least there'd be none of this distressing and, I think, inhuman flogging. Quite a different ship from one that I was lent to last, where the grating was rigged almost every day." "Maturin." "Just so. But then you're to consider that the men of the Surprise have served together for years. They're all man-of-war's men, with no recently pressed landlubbers, no Lord Mayor's men among them. All tolerably expert sailors who work together and who need no running at, nor any of the starting, reviling and threats so usual in less happy ships. But the Surprise cannot be taken as at all typical of the Navy, alas." "Martin." "No, indeed. Yet even here there's sometimes a vehemency of rebuke that I, for one, should find hard to bear if it were addressed to me." "Maturin." "You're thinking of the, 'Oh, you wicked mutinous dog, sons of everlasting whores.' At a particularly busy moment, awkward Davis and his mates, eluding their young gentleman, tried to pass a light hawser aft for the painter's stages, not as they were ordered, but according to their own lights. And this passionate cry from the quarter-deck had greeted the parting of an entangled lower stunsail boom." "Harsh words, sure, but, God love you, they would bear infinitely harsher from Mr. Aubrey, and still give no more than a tolerant smile and a droll wag of their head.
He's one of the most resolute of fighting captains, and that's a quality they prize above anything. They would still value him extremely if he were severe, unjust, tyrannical, sombre, revengeful, malice-bearing, and he's none of these things. Certainly not. A most gentlemanlike, estimable character indeed, said Martin, leaning over the top rim to see the last of the rocks, now far astern, almost lost in the shimmering heat. Yet even so, such inflexibility. 5,000 miles of ocean and not 5 minutes' stay to be contemplated, but don't think I complain. That'll be wicked ingratitude after the sight of the blue-faced booby of 6 blue-faced boobies. I perfectly remember your warning me that for a naturalist the naval life was one of 999 opportunities lost, and one that might perhaps be seized. Yet the evil one will be reminding me that tomorrow we are to heave to and lie motionless heaven knows how long with the ceremony of crossing the line. A muted ceremony, however, for most exceptionally it took place on a Sunday when church was rigged. And even more exceptionally it took place in a newly painted ship, with all hands acutely aware of their best clothes on the one hand and of the wet paint, the freshly laid on pitch tar, and the still moist black streak just above the whales on the other. Furthermore, Mr. Martin had read a grave sermon by Dean Dunn, and the choir had sung some particularly moving hymns and psalms. There were Africans, Poles, Dutchmen, a broad category, Letts, Malays, and even a mute solitary Finn on the surprises books, but most of her people were English, and Anglican at that, and the service brought home very much to mind. In general, the mood remained serious even after Sunday duff and grog, and those few volatile spirits who would be fooling were perpetually reminded to watch out for the paintwork, mate, mind your bleeding step, by those who would have to make all good if anything was smeared. The surprise did back her foretopsail and lie to almost on the very line itself. Badgerbag did come aboard with his train, exchanging the customary greetings and witticisms with the captain of the ship and calling for those who'd not crossed the equator before to redeem themselves or be shaved. Martin and the youngsters paid their forfeit, and the others, all of them former defenders, were brought to the tub. But there wasn't much zeal in the shaving. Again and again Badgerbag's style was cramped by cries of, "Mind the paintwork, Joe!" And his usual obscene merriment couldn't really flow free on a Sunday in the presence of a parson. And presently it was over, with no harm done, only a certain feeling of flatness. And even that was remedied by a concert in the evening, the ship's first in the southern hemisphere, with all hands singing and Orange the Cook coming out very strong with the British tars. "Come, all you thoughtless young men, a warning take by me, and never leave your happy homes to sail the raging sea." Mr. Martin hadn't visited the Canaries, nor the Cape Verdes, nor yet St. Paul's Rocks. And presently it seemed that he was to be done out of the new world, too. 5 days later, the surprise raised Cape Saint-Roch at dawn, a dim, remote headland, and then bore away to cruise in the most frequented shipping lanes, where the currents and the local winds brought most vessels from North America and the West Indies quite close in shore south of Recife, off the broad estuary of the San Francisco River. Quite close inshore, that's to say, from a sailor's point of view, since the land could actually be seen if one ascended to the masthead, a faint line, rather harder and a little more irregular than cloud. Here Jack meant to stand off and on, with the barge just in sight in the offing and the launch beyond it waiting for the Norfolk. He hadn't been on his chosen station more than a few hours when the morning sun showed him the amiable Catherine of London, homeward bound from the River Plate. The Catherine had not the slightest wish to speak to the surprise. knowing very well that the frigate might press several of her best hands, but she had no choice. Jack had the weather gauge, a much faster ship, and 10 times the number of men to spread her canvas. Her master came aboard with a glum face and the Catherine's papers. He left, looking pleased and somewhat drunken, since Jack, both from natural choice and policy, always treated merchant captains civilly. The Catherine hadn't seen or heard of the Norfolk, nor of any other American man-of-war in southern waters. No talk of any such thing in Montevideo, St. Catherine's, Rio, or Bahia. She'd take great care of surprises, letters, and put them straight into the post, and she wished her a very happy return. 4 more ships or barks gave the same news in the course of the day. So did a pilot boat that came out to ask whether they wanted to go up the river to Ponedo. On coming aboard, the pilot startled the quarterdeck by uttering a delighted screech and kissing Mr. Allen on both cheeks. The master had once spent a considerable time in the pilot's father's house in the port of Ponedo, recovering from the dry gripes. But he then won the good opinion of all within earshot by assuring the captain that no man-of-war could possibly have passed the headlands without his knowledge. The anxiety that had been growing so in Jack Aubrey's mind dissolved, leaving a delicious feeling of pure relief. Although he'd taken such an unconscionable time in getting there, he was still ahead of the American. "This is capital," he said to Pullings and Mowat. "I don't think we shall have to cruise here for so long as a week, even if Norfolk's had very indifferent breezes. If we stand well off, keeping the double-headed hill on our beam, she should pass inshore, which gives us the advantage of the current and the weather gauge, and then heave a Saffron Walden. Not that I think that she'd decline an engagement, even if she were to windward of us." "The water," began pulling. "Yes, yes, there is the water," said Jack, "but we have enough for nearly a week on short allowance, and in these latitudes at this time of the year I've rarely known a week go by without rain pouring down. We must have our casks and awnings ready at the first drop, and if it don't rain, why, we can run in. The master knows a good watering place no great way up the river, leaving the boats to keep watch. Even if she does slip by, she'll not have any very great start, and we can make it up by cracking on before she's aware." The long days passed, furiously hot, horribly thirsty. The heat pleased some, Stephen among them, and the Finn, who silently took off his fur hat for the first time since Gibraltar. But Mr. Adams, on the other hand, was all agasp and a swim, obliged to be sponged in a hammock under the weather awnings, and Mrs. Horner lost her looks entirely, going yellow and thin. It was also observed that her songbird lost his voice. No more gathering flowers in May, no more rose in June, no more flaming Spanish guitar on the gangway, neither. But the guilty pair no longer excited any very considerable interest, partly because they seemed to have grown much more cautious, partly because their liaison had lasted so many thousands of miles that it was now almost respectable, but very much more because all hands were engaged in such strenuous gunnery practice in such heat that they had little energy left for adultery, the contemplation of adultery. It was now that Captain Aubrey's private powder came into its own. Horner and his mates filled cartridge by the hour, and every evening at quarters the surprise erupted in deadly earnest. The long, savage flames and the smoke jetting from her sides in rippling broadsides running from the bow guns aft, fired at empty beef casks, towed out 500 yards, very often with shattering effect and with something close to the old surprise's speed of 1 minute 10 seconds between 2 discharges of each gun, although almost every crew contained a Defender or a Gibraltar lunatic. In the afternoon of the 5th day, the wind came off the land, bringing with it the smell of tropical river mud and green forest. But no rain, alas. Only a single chrysomelid beetle on the wing.
the first true South American that Martin had ever seen. He hurried below to show Stephen, but Higgins told him that the doctor was engaged. Would Mr. Martin sit down and take one of the invalid's thin captain biscuits and a trifle of the sick bay brandy? Martin had barely time to decline. A biscuit in such arid heat was a physical impossibility unless it was accompanied by something far wetter, far more voluminous than brandy, before the gunner walked out, looking black and grim. It may be nondescript, said Stephen, peering at the beetle through a magnifying glass. I certainly haven't seen it before, and can scarcely even guess its genus. He gave the creature back into Martin's hand, and then said, Oh, Mr. Martin, my quotation came back to me together with the author's name. Sénac de Meillan. I made him speak a little more emphatically than I should have done, I'm afraid. What he really said was, even the best-conducted women, les plus sages, have an aversion for the impotent going on, and old men are despised, so one should conceal one's wounds and hide the crippling deficiencies of life, poverty, misfortune, sickness, ill success. People begin by being touched and moved to tenderness by their friend's distress. Presently this changes to pity, which has something humiliating about it, then to a masterful giving of advice, and then to scorn. Of course, the later considerations have nothing to do with the subject we were discussing, but they seem to me... Lieutenant Mowat, my dear, what can I do for you? I beg your pardon for bursting in upon your beetle, said Mowat, but the captain would like to know whether the human frame can support this. He passed a mug of the rainwater collected long ago north of the line. Stephen smelt to it, poured a little into a phial, and looked at it with a lens. Delight dawned upon his grave, considering face, and spread wide. "Will you look at this now?" he said, passing it to Martin. "Perhaps the finest conferva soup I've ever seen, and I believe I make out some African forms. There are also some ill-looking polyps, and some creatures no doubt close kin to the hydroblabs," said Martin. "I shouldn't drink it for a deanery." "Pray tell the captain that it will not do," said Stephen, "and that he will be obliged to bear up, bear down, bear away for that noble stream to San Francisco and fill our casks from its limpid, health-giving billows as they flow between banks covered with the luxuriant vegetation of choice exotics, echoing to the cries of the toucan, the jaguar, various apes, the 100 species of parrots, and they flying among gorgeous orchids while huge butterflies of unparalleled splendour float over a ground strewn with Brazil nuts and boa constrictors. Martin gave an involuntary skip, but Mowat replied, he was afraid you'd say that. And if you did, I was to apply to Mr. Martin and ask him, in a very tactful, discreet manner, whether the prayers for rain we use at home could be applied to a ship at sea. Because, you know, we're most unwilling to leave our station to fetch wet, if wet can, as you might say, be induced to come to us. Prayers for rain at sea? Said the chaplain. I doubt it'd be orthodox. But I'll look in my books and tell you what I find tomorrow. I'm not sure that we shall have to wait until tomorrow, said Jack, when this message reached him. Look away to leeward. There, far down the evening wind, dark clouds were gathering on the horizon, and in spite of the brilliant sun in the west, lightning could be seen flickering under them. Even here the air was electrical, and the boatswain's cat sprang about the forecastle rigging in a high state of excitement, its fur standing on end. Perhaps it did not be tempting fate, was we to lay along the clean awnings and funnels? Said Pullings. Fate might bear it this once, said Jack. She's hardly used us very kindly so far, I believe. And what's more, I think we might be well advised to get the topgallant masts down on deck and rig rolling tackles, the swell's increasing. Pullings did these things, and when the boats returned from their distant watch, she had them brought inboard and made fast to the skid beams rather than towing astern. All this seemed labour lost until the middle watch, when Maitland, Hollam and the Larbalins took over from Honey.
"You're a good relief, Maitland," said Honey,
and then in a formal voice,
"Here you have her. Close reef topsails and inner jib, course east-southwest until two bells, then wear ship and west-northwest until the end of the watch. If rain falls, take appropriate measures."
"East-southeast, then wear ship appropriate measures," said Maitland.
"Lord! What light balls!" cried Hollam, the mate of the watch, pointing forward to the St. Elmo's fire, flickering about the jib boom and spritsail yard, brilliant in the faint moonlight.
"Don't point at them, for heaven's sake," said Honey. "It brings bad luck. The awnings are in the waist, the hoses stretched along, and battle lanterns are ready under the forecastle. If there's any justice, we should have something like Noah's flood before morning, from the look of things to leeward."
"Do you think we should tell the doctor about the fireballs?" asked Maitland. "They're prodigious curious."
"Why," said Honey, considering, "I did think of it, but they're only electrical, you know. And I don't know he'd thank us for waking him up just to see the electrical fluid playing the fool. If they had feathers and laid eggs, I should have said long ago."
Stephen, therefore, knew nothing of St. Elmo's fire. Far below, swinging in an ever-widening but always peaceful arc as the swell increased, his ears blocked with balls of wax, and his mind, hitherto much harassed by thoughts of Diana and by the oppressive, unbreathable air, now soothed by a judicious dose of laudanum, he knew nothing of the torrential rain that half drowned the ship in the graveyard watch, nor of the subsequent near tornado that flung her so violently about amidst bellowing thunder no higher than the mastheads and an almost continuous blaze of blue and orange lightning. The laudanum he had returned to at last because, after mature and wholly objective consideration, he'd been brought to see that as a physician he was required to sleep well enough to perform his duty the next day. Furthermore, the poppy had not been created idly, and a rejection of the natural balms provided was contumelious pride, as heretical as the notion that because a thing was pleasant it was also sinful. And in any case, this was St. Abdon's Day. After his long abstinence, it worked beautifully. But even half a pint of laudanum, and he was nowhere near his old excesses, couldn't have kept out the enormous crash as lightning struck the surprise, melting the shank of her best bower anchor, running along the seven foremost larboard guns and setting them off, but above all rending and shattering her iron hoop bowsprit in the most extraordinary manner.
"The French fleet is out," thought Stephen, three parts awake. "I must get my instruments, go to my station. God between us and evil."
Then, waking a little more, as his bare feet plunged into the rainwater, swilling to and fro under his hanging cot,
"Nonsense! This is the New World, and we are at war with the Americans, ridiculous as it may appear."
However, he heard no more gunfire. And after a good deal of reflection and some unsuccessful attempts at striking a light, he made his way on deck, which was lit fore and aft with lanterns. The ship lay head to wind, and the fire engine was playing on the smoking wreckage of the bowsprit. This last enormous blast had exhausted the storm, and although the sea was still high, the sky was clearing over the land. He learnt from other night-shirted figures that this was not warfare, that nobody had been hurt, and that the situation was in hand. He retired to the almost deserted quarter-deck and sat on a carronade slide. He heard the cry of "There she goes!" as the outer 40 feet of the bowsprit plunged into the sea with a rending sound and a splash, followed by a good many orders. Then the officers came flooding back aft. Martin was among them, and seeing Stephen, he joined him and said in a low voice, "It appears that we've lost our bowsprit." The captain seems deeply concerned.
Aye, said Stephen. They value it much as essential for turning into the wind. Or perhaps from it.
Mr. Allen, said Jack, the breeze is fair. You know these waters. Can you take the ship up to Penedo?
No, sir, said the master. Neither with nor without your bowsprit. The shoals in the estuary are always shifting, and the river's as much pilot water as the Hoogly. I couldn't in conscience venture upon it, even if we had a compass we could rely upon, which we've not. Nor even if it was clear daylight. But if I may have the launch, I'll run in, send off the pilot, and set Lopez's yard a-working on a new spar as fast as ever they can go. With this breeze and the turn of the tide, I should be there soon after dawn, and maybe the ship could stand in, cautious, and drop anchor in, say, 20 fathom water, about 2 or 3 mile off the bar.
Very good, Mr. Allen, said Jack. Make it so.
Since the foremast's main support had gone with the bowsprit, it took some little time to get the swift-sailing copper-bottomed launch over the side. And while this was going on, Stephen said to the master,
Mr. Allen, can I be of any use to you? I'm sure I'm moderately fluent in Portuguese.
Oh, dear me, no, Doctor, though I thank you very kindly. I'm like one of the family with the Lopezes and with the Moreiras. But I tell you what it is. If you don't mind a little wetting, and if you like to come along with me, I think I can show you something uncommon in the botanical line, if the floods haven't carried it away, which ain't likely. Parson Martin's welcome too, if so inclined. No one can call me superstitious.
The launch was a fine boat, but she was not a dry one. She skimmed through the water, shipping large packets of it at every plunge of the long swell, two hands bailing and the master at the tiller, steering by the Southern Cross. Everybody was soaked and almost cold by the time they were well into the estuary, with the bar breaking the swell and the master often letting fly the sheet as he picked out the channel, straining forward to see the rises of the land in the dim grey light, the first hint of dawn. Twice the launch grounded slightly, but a seaman on either side, no more than thigh-deep, soon heaved her off, and at last, seeing a tall stake with a rag on top, Allen said, "Here we are," and sent the boat slanting across the stream to a long, low island, brought her gently to a halt in the sand of its shore, and as Macbeth leapt out with the gangboard for Stephen and Martin, he said, I'll just run up to Penedo now to arrange with the yard, and I'll tell the pilot to bring you some breakfast on his way out to the ship. Shove off, Macbeth. And when the boat was some way out on the smooth water, he called back, Mind the alligators, gentlemen. They were standing on a firm, white strand, and already there was light enough to see that a little way up the slope there began a grove of trees. But surely too high, too massive to be trees. The light increased, and trees they were. Palms of an almost unbelievable mass and height, their enormous fan-shaped leaves bursting in a vegetable explosion well over 100 feet above their heads, and outlined sharp against the greying sky.
Would they be Mauritia vinifera?
Asked Martin in a whisper.
Mauritia of some kind, sure, but what, I cannot tell, said Stephen.
They walked slowly, reverently into the grove. There was no undergrowth, and spring tides, or perhaps floods, kept the ground quite clean, so that the magnificent trees rose sheer, each some 10 yards from the next, a vast grey column. Their feet made no sound as they paced on, but very soon it was darkness that they were walking into, for the dense fronds intertwined far overhead, and except at its fringes the grove was still filled with warm, silent night, the pale trunks soaring up into obscurity. They turned right-handed with one accord, and as they reached the outer edge again, facing the river and the strand, the sun heaved up from the eastern sea, sending an instant brilliance across the water to the other bank, no great way off. The reflected light and colour of the far bank fairly blazed upon them as they stood there in the shade of the remaining trees, a bank with a line of shining sand, and then a great wall of the most intensely vivid green, an almost violent green, with palms of 20 or 30 different kinds soaring above it, all in the total silence of a dream. Martin clasped his hands as he gazed, uttering some private ejaculations, and Stephen, touching his elbow, nodded towards three trees some way up the river. Three enormous cathedral-like domes that rose 200 feet above the rest, one of them completely covered with deep red flowers. They took a few more steps through the palms, reaching the white, unshaded strand. To the left hand, at the water's edge, lay a 20-foot cayman, contemplating the gentle stream. And to the right hand, full in the brilliant sun, there stood a scarlet ibis.